Gentlemen, good morning. We'll call this hearing to docket HP07-001 to order, and this deals with the application by TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP for a permit under the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facility Act to construct the Keystone Pipeline Project. The time this morning is approximately 9:30 in the morning, and the date is December 3rd, 2007, and the location of the hearing is here in room 412 of the State Capitol and Pier. I'm Dusty Johnson, Commission Chairman. With me this morning are Commissioners Steve Colbeck and Gary Hansen. I'm presiding over this hearing. This hearing was noticed pursuant to Commission Scheduling and Procedural Order issued August 23, 2007. The issue at this hearing is whether TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP should be granted a permit to construct the Keystone Crude Oil Pipeline in South Dakota. It is the applicant that has the burden of proof, and under 49-41B22, that burden of proof is fourfold. First, that the proposed facility will comply with all applicable laws and rules. Secondly, that the facility will not pose a threat of serious injury to the environment, nor to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants in the siting area. Third, that the facility will not substantially impair the health, safety, or welfare of the inhabitants. And finally, that the facility will not unduly interfere with the orderly development of the region, with due consideration having been given the views of governing bodies of affected local units of government. All parties have the right to be present and to be represented by an attorney. All persons testifying will be sworn in and subject to cross-examination by the parties. The Commission's final decision may be appealed by the parties to the State Circuit Court and finally to the State Supreme Court. John Smith, the Commission's counsel, will act as hearing examiner and will conduct the hearing subject to the Commission's oversight. He may provide recommended rulings on procedural as well as evidentiary matters. The Commission may overrule its counsel's preliminary rulings throughout the hearing. If his rulings are not overruled, those preliminary rulings will become final rulings. With that, we will turn it over to Mr. Smith to conduct the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, everyone. Just one last reminder that I would ask that people make sure your cell phones are turned off. Not a real big deal, but it is interruptive of the proceedings. So please either leave them downstairs or turn them off if you would. With that, we'll begin the hearing. And I think at the outset, I'm going to ask of counsel and parties whether there are any preliminary matters that we wish to dispose of or take up before we turn to the applicant's case in chief.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. This is Brett Kennecke for the applicant. We do have some preliminary matters to go through. If the parties and the commission will permit me, perhaps I'll take the lead on what I think those matters are, and then we can flesh those out. First off, we did file motions late last week relative to the late filed testimony of Perry Ron and also to the motion in limine regarding the discussions of matters surrounding land acquisition and eminent domain. If the commission would wish to take those up at this time, those are things that we think are hanging out there that need to be decided at some point here during the hearings and probably initially. We have a number of exhibits. As everyone knows, the filings have been voluminous on our part, and the witness table is essentially covered with large documents which represent essentially the application and the exhibits which were filed. I've asked staff and I've asked counsel for Webb Water if we could stipulate to the admission of the application and exhibits A, B, and D to the application. Exhibit C, if you'll recall, was very voluminous and contained a substantial amount of information which was not relevant to the proceedings in South Dakota in my view. And I've prepared a list of Exhibit C as it was filed and Exhibit C as I wish to have the parts of it introduced into the record and become evidence. And I've asked Mrs. Colbo downstairs to make copies of that for everyone's review so we can see where we're at with that matter. I understand we've got an agreement to stipulate with staff and Webb Waters Council. I don't know about the remainder of the interveners. We'll have to take that up as well. that constitutes my understanding of what we'd like to discuss before we start calling witnesses. Mr. Smith, thank you.
Commissioners, and how do you wish? Let me ask you a question, Mr. Kennecke, right up front. Both of the motions that you filed deal with intervener testimony, which we are a couple of days away from hearing. Are these motions something that might be better addressed at the point in time when we are ready to begin with the intervener's testimony?
I don't know, Mr. Smith. Thank you for the question. I don't know, as I sit here, what the intentions of staff and the parties are as to cross-examination of my witnesses with respect to those matters. That would be one thing I could think of that we should consider in the timing of when to dispose of that motion.
Just to add to that, Mr. Smith, if it's appropriate, I probably would have questions based on information filed by other parties for TransCanada once they're up, as opposed to having them called back up as some sort of rebuttal witness.
Okay, I'm not quite sure I'm following. Are you stating then you're recommending then that we take this up right now?
I think that would be most appropriate.
Okay. Well, let's turn which one first. I'll tell you one particular that with respect to the Perry Ron exhibit, his late filed testimony, for whatever reason. I guess I'm a little bit, I would probably rather have the benefit of having Mr. Ron here so we can ask him what happened, as opposed to doing that without the benefit of that. I'd be willing to hear from other parties, staff or Mr. Rasmussen on that.
I can address that, and I guess we might have some additional information, some copies of FedEx receipt slips, that sort of thing, but later on, which I don't have right now. But my understanding is Mr. Hone was primarily responsible for filing the web expert testimony, and my understanding is that his office attempted to file Mr. Ron's testimony on, I believe it's the 13th of November was our date. And in fact, there is a email cover letter, so to speak, that says enclosed is the Ron and the, what's the other guy's name?
Davis
testimony. For some reason, the PUC website rejected the Ron testimony. And we believe it's because there was a map that was too extensive or something. I'm not a computer guy, but that's my understanding, that it was kicked back, and there were several efforts made to resubmit it. The technician at Webb contacted someone here at the PUC and was told that there was some sort of problem with the settings on the computer, and it couldn't be accepted. It was then, my understanding was FedEx then to the commission that day by mail. Now, I also understand some people, and Mr. Kennecke may be one of them, did not receive it through the Internet. Some people did, or through email. Some people did. But it was Mr. Hone's understanding, though, that it had been filed. It was not until the 26th or 27th of November when I was looking at the PUC website and going through all the direct testimony that had been filed, and I saw that Mr. Ron's name was not listed. I contacted Mr. Hone and asked him if he knew why, and he didn't. And then at that point in time, it was resubmitted by the by email, and maybe that's when Mr. Kennecke first received it. I don't know the answer to that. But that's basically the background. We feel that we did attempt to get it filed as ordered by the commission, and in fact it was, I believe, FedEx to the commission on the 13th of November and should have then been received presumably the next day. That's my understanding of the background. And Mr. Hone might be able to provide more information if you want to hear from him, since his office was the one that was handling this.
We seem to be getting into the merits of the issue a little bit, Mr. Smith. Have you determined whether or not you want to take this question up now, or?
You know, I don't know. I guess the question I would have had for Mr. Ron is just he dated his testimony on the 13th of November. That's the date of it. Would just be to ask him, did you in fact, is that date in fact accurate? And did you in fact sign that and date it that day? That's really about it. I mean, just looking at the, I don't get to see all of the emails and whatever that are involved in filing. That doesn't come to me. I'm just like you guys. I see it when it posts up on the website. And I did notice the omission of the Perry Ron testimony that day. But I didn't see the email that said attached are both the Ron and our person downstairs. You know, they don't, our administrative people, they don't delve into what's in attachments in detail. You know, she would have had no way of knowing, you know, or would not have checked to see whether both of those testimonies was there. She just noticed there was one, she saw that there was one attachment containing 16 pages. And so whether it was a case of, and then I note Kurt Hone resent an email with Mr. Davis's testimony on again. You know, it's just hard for us to know what happened. I think bottom line for us, if it was a mistake or whatever, I know my attitude about it would be a lot different than if it was just a intentional filing late. For me, that would matter. The testimony isn't lengthy, and so I don't view it as something that would be that difficult for applicant and staff to address. So I don't know, commissioners, what you think. Perhaps you want to wait until Mr. Ron is here. I hate to have him come and then and we exclude him. But what do you think?
If you're looking for direction, I would think this commission has historically erred on the side of making certain we hear everything as opposed to excluding something on something of that interest. I would think that we would hear him.
With that, I am going to deny the motion to exclude the Ron testimony and accept it as it was filed, admittedly late. Moving on then to the motion in limine, do you want to address that, Mr. Kennecke, now?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Mr. Smith. It's been widely reported and known to those of us, since the June hearings, that the matters involving land acquisition, the easements which have been signed, the condemnation actions which have been filed, are all matters which are outside, I believe, the purview of the commission. I am not aware of a grant of authority from the legislature to hear those things, and I think that resides in the circuit courts, and we think that those matters are properly heard and held there or aired between the parties, a landowner and TransCanada, and not probably appropriate for this hearing. I foresee a lengthening of this hearing with matters which I don't find to be terrifically relevant to the issues at hand, not at all relevant, and we would ask the commission to essentially order that's not going to be heard, that we're not going to go down that road in these hearings, and that we're going to stick to the four issues which are in 49, 41B22, which are properly here today.
Mr. Rasmussen?
Yes, John. I guess from Webb's standpoint, I don't know that, you know, we intend to specifically offer testimony about the eminent domain proceedings, but I think I hate to have a restriction placed upon what the issues are that can be addressed, particularly, and I don't represent interveners, but I'm certain that this is probably more of an issue that some of the interveners want to address, and maybe it would be more appropriate for one of them to respond to the motion. I would urge that it be denied, because I think, as Commissioner Hansen indicated, it's better to let things in than to start excluding a lot of stuff. But I guess that'd be my position on it.
Staff, do you have a position?
The offices care, a similar for staff. Staff, too, does not believe that those issues are pertinent to the statutory elements at issue and would support the motion to exclude that testimony.
Other parties wish to... Sir, could you please get up and take the mic, introduce yourself, and talk into the mic, please.
Good morning. My name is Kent Beckley, and I'm a landowner, Marshall County, in South Dakota, and lie under the proposed route that the Canadian company would like to take down through our state. I have been here on a few hearings, listened to an awful lot of hearings around the state. I've watched the actions of TransCanada and their representatives, dealt with them, many of them. And it appears to me that the province of this whole proceedings is for representatives of the people of South Dakota to act for us. I'm very concerned about this, to act for us, the landowners, we the people of South Dakota. And it seems to me that everything is relevant in light of the fact that this foreign company attempts to come in here, take our land, act any way they want, print anything in the paper they want, half-truths, makes no difference. In some cases, lies to we, the landowners. It would seem to me that the only way you, as representatives of me and all the other landowners, can make a valid decision on this application is for you to hear everything about all that has gone on and all that this company has attempted to do already in this state. And it seems to me that they have to be responsible for their actions, and you need to hear about everything. It's a social economic issue. It's part of their obligation, and I feel that you should entertain and listen to any comments about any of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meckley. Anyone else wish to address this? Mr. Hone.
Members of the commission, Mr. Smith, my name is Kurt Hone. I'm filed as an intervener, as a citizen of the state. I'm also associated with Webb Water, which is an intervener. I'll be very brief. There are four burdens of proof, and one of them is a socioeconomic. And while the details of a negotiation or a legal purchase or a condemnation may not be relevant, the socioeconomic impact of having land taken from somebody is an impact. And to some people, it's a very big impact. It'll be an impact on a community. There are, at this time, 18 landowners who've been condemned or filed. There probably will be more. There could be hundreds before this is done. And that's going to happen in each county. If some resolution isn't reached here at the commission level in these hearings. And so if you look at trying to resolve, holding hearings to try to hear both sides, the jury, it almost looks like a jury room over here, and there's one attorney on this side. I think you can level the playing field and allow everyone to speak. We're going to live with whatever's done for 50 years or more. It would seem that they would have the time to listen to some of the people they're impacting. And if you want to instruct the witnesses as to what you would rather not hear versus what they might say, the legal negotiation maybe isn't relevant or shouldn't be brought up, but the effect is, the social impact is. I would think we have time. If we're going to live with a pipeline for 50 years, maybe we give a few minutes to the landowner. You can't separate the two. And they didn't ask to be crossed. They're going to be crossed. It would seem like these people and the commission could give them that time and then make your judgment. Thank you.
Anyone else? I guess, Mr. Kaneki, I want to, you know, the second factor that we look at that you have the burden of proving is that the facility will not pose a threat of serious injury, and then I'm going to leave out a few words, to the social and economic condition of inhabitants or expected inhabitants. And I guess, you know, I look at that and I say, well, on some level, a company's behavior in dealing with land, and I'm not presuming that it's been bad, but I'm saying, and it, to me, at some level, I would think that those relationships probably have some relevance to that factor. Based upon my reading of the, I'm just going to tell you right now kind of a take I have on this whole thing is that some of the testimony I've read that delves into legal issues related to eminent domain, I think I do not think that's relevant on the one hand, and I also think it's pure questions of law that that are not really suitable for evidence. But in terms of the actual landowner relationship, actions, that kind of thing, in terms of what that might speak to the ways in which the company, the applicant, does things, to me, I think I might have to agree with the interveners and say that on some level, at least, that would seem to me to be relevant. I don't know if commissioners have any thoughts on that.
Mr. Smith, is there a mechanism by which you have in mind where we would limit the, I just think the real danger, I mean, I have a tendency to agree with everything you said. I do think there's a danger. I mean, there are really important questions at stake here, and could they get buried or, you know, really buried under by a lot of concerns about eminent domain and about landowner compensation? I want to make sure we get to the heart of the issue. Is there a way in which we can focus testimony toward the issues of concern that you and I share without?
Well, I think there is. Rather than a blanket motion in limine, which, you know, the boundaries of it are difficult to determine, the way we would deal with it is we will make rulings on particular questions. The applicant, staff, each of the interveners has the right to object to testimony that they find to be irrelevant or not based on adequate foundation, et cetera. And I guess from my standpoint, rather than a very broad blanket ruling, that we take those matters up with respect to ruling on specific objections as they occur. That would be what I would recommend.
Is there any value in making it clear, maybe in granting the motion in part, that we don't want to attempt to litigate those issues which will be clearly litigated in a circuit court?
Well, I think so. In terms of directory, I mean, we can't, this commission doesn't make determinations, for example, concerning whether or not a company is a common carrier. That is not before this commission. The eminent domain proceedings are a circuit court matter. In some other states, the law doesn't read that way. In some other states, their particular commissions do have to authorize the use of eminent domain. In South Dakota, it just doesn't work that way. Our statute prohibits construction without a permit, and it's extremely clear in the definition of the statute that construction means moving dirt, and it doesn't involve landowner acquisition, that kind of thing. And so I think when we cross into those kind of issues in terms of whether or not, and we don't have any power, this commission certainly doesn't have the power if the legislature has given eminent domain power, and I don't know that it has, that's for the court to decide. But to the extent the legislature has given that power to a company, we certainly do not have the legal ability to second-guess the legislature on that grant of authority. I mean, we just don't.
So, Mr. Smith, my question would be, is there an appropriate way in which we would focus the testimony away from some of those legal, purely legal issues and towards some of the more factual matters with regard to treatment of landowners by the applicant?
Well, I think there is. If you wanted to grant the motion in part with respect to the availability of eminent domain in this particular situation and what the law is and all of that and the fact that the companies filed eminent domain proceedings, I think that's properly excludable. That kind of testimony really is not something that's before this commission. And if you want to grant it in part with respect to that, I think that would be appropriate. With respect to the general, subject of conduct of the company and its dealings with landowners, I really believe that testimony is at least relevant, and we'll deal with that on a case-by-case basis. How's that? And if that's what you want to do, I would recommend that one of you make a motion to that effect.
From a procedural standpoint, Mr. Smith, since we've indicated you'll be making preliminary rulings, and I certainly don't mind, at some point the commissioners will be on record on this issue regardless. Either they'll make a motion or overrule you or they won't, but procedurally, what's the best way to...
Well, if you want me to just make a ruling, I'll make it. I'll grant the motion with respect to evidence involving the availability of eminent domain, and whether or not the company has it or doesn't have it. And its actual invocation by the company in a few cases, as has been noted, as it's not something we have the authority to deal with, and it's not relevant. I'm going to deny the motion with respect to general questions and testimony that might be offered relative to company conduct in its dealings with landowners. To me, that's relevant to the social and economic impacts of the project.
Mr. Smith, how about as to compensation?
I think compensation is an issue that's an issue that we don't have authority to deal with. To me, compensation has been committed to the courts through the eminent domain statutes. And that is not something that this commission really has the legal authority to rule on. The court will have ultimately, if it determines that eminent domain is available, the court will have to determine what is appropriate compensation. The jury will.
Thank you.
With that, any other preliminary matters before we begin?
Do you have the copies of the differences in Exhibit C that we'd like to stipulate in the record at this time, if you'd like to handle that?
Okay. Yes, let's do that right now.
Mr. Smith, Mrs. Axelm is passing out is two documents which look substantially similar. You'll have to pay attention to the boldface type on the top. Exhibit C is filed initially. This is taken from the commission's website, the rundown of Exhibit C, which everyone should be familiar with from the commission's website. What I've done then on Exhibit C, introduced exhibits, is pared down the Exhibit C, which was filed initially, to that which I seek to have introduced and put into evidence during the hearing. I haven't sought to introduce the bat reports from Illinois or the snake reports from Kansas. If someone wants those in, they'll have to do that on their own. But the South Dakota relevant documents are found on Exhibit C, introduced exhibits, and I would ask at this time if all parties would stipulate to the introduction of the application, Exhibit A, B, C as on the introduced exhibits, and D. I think we'll have a much easier time of it today if we don't have to unbundle these and go through with the individual witnesses each piece and put them in as might otherwise be required. So I would ask the parties to stipulate to that.
No objection.
No objection.
And if I'm understanding, the material you've removed is the material pertaining to other states.
That's correct. There are matters, thank you for asking that, on Exhibit C, which have been deemed not available to the public. They've been available to parties pursuant to the Commission's confidentiality order of September since that time. And if we do need to discuss those and have them discussed here, that we'll have to observe those protocols at that time.
Thank you. And are the booklets that I see piled up over there, do those reflect this on the Exhibit C, introduced exhibits?
As to Exhibit C, there is some question still. Exhibit C, as found on the desk, represents Exhibit C on introduced exhibits, but Exhibit C on the desk does not include the confidential material, which we are going to produce separately at those times, at which time they might come up. So that'll be coming up here yet this morning.
Okay. So, but other than that, the books that you've got up there now already have, they do not include the Missouri bat studies and all of that.
The bat reports, the Topeka Shiner from Kansas, not there. If someone wants to introduce that, they would have to do that of their own volition if they deemed it appropriate and necessary to do so. It's just that on this sheet, introduced exhibits is essentially what's over there, minus the not available to the public, which will be done separately.
Commissioner Johnson?
We have a large number of pro se interveners. Were you going to see if there was any objection on that front?
Yeah, and I'm seeing some fidgeting going on over there. Mr. Rasmussen, any other comments? Or?
No, we're still fine. We're just talking about something else.
Oh, okay. Okay. Any other intervener have a problem with that? Again, it's just the removal of the out-of-state stuff, and I can tell you right now we don't have any authority to deal with that anyway. It's irrelevant. So with that, I think your exhibits then have been stipulated to, does that include the application itself? Was that part of your motion?
Yes, the application itself, as amended in a few pages. That was done late summer, as I recall. There were a few pages that needed amendments.
And what are the, would you please identify it? What is this? Is this, what's the exhibit called? Is it called TC1? And then,
the application is TC1. Exhibit A to the application then is TC1A. Exhibit B is TC1B, C, and D.
Pursuant to the stipulation of the parties, exhibits TC1, TC1A, TC1B, TC1C, and TC1D are admitted into evidence. Other preliminary matters?
Given my success with that motion, which is somewhat unprecedented, I would ask if the parties would agree to this stipulation into evidence of the direct and rebuttal testimony of our witnesses. It's just the stuff that we filed and served on the parties in September and then again in November. If I think we can save ourselves some time there as well if people would be agreeable to that.
Other parties?
There's no objection on behalf of Webb.
Staff has no objection.
Other interveners, objection? Okay, I'm not sure what the marking and numbering of all of that is, but there being no objection, maybe we can just... do you have all that, Sherry?
guess the parties have shared it in advance, but we perhaps have left out the court reporter. I'd be glad to recite it for people who'd be interested. Robert Jones had direct testimony. He is TC2D, D for direct. Michael Koski is TC3, D for direct, R for rebuttal. Scott Ellis is TC4, D for direct, then R for rebuttal. Buster Gray, 5D and 5R. Again, TC, TransCanada, 5, Buster, D direct, R rebuttal. Mira Kothari had two rebuttals, so we have her earlier rebuttal would be 6R1, her rebuttal 2 would be the later. Heidi Tilquist is TC7D and 7R. Brian Thomas is 8D and 8R. And we'll provide a copy of this to the court reporter as soon as we can here.
As we go along, I mean, I wasn't able to get all that written down, Mr. Kaneki. So as we go along, if you would be so kind as to refresh, I guess, as we go along, I'd appreciate it. Anything else? Otherwise, please proceed with your case in chief. And basically, one word of explanation about what we're going to do here. Again, we've got a mountain of stuff that that we've had filed over the last couple of months. Generally, our practice here is that we have the witness, and we've all read and reviewed that. It's been available to the media. It's been available to everybody in the state via our public website. I think what we usually do in these cases where we have pre-filed testimony is we have the witness sworn, qualified. He provides some foundation for the testimony, and then a short summary. And we like to avoid having the short summary turn into a complete repetition of the material that we've already all seen, so that the witness can be tendered promptly for cross-examination.
Mr. Smith, I think that's a good point. I did happen to see on the schedule of witnesses that I think somebody was planning a one-hour presentation. And to me, that would seem to run contrary to what we had set out as the operating procedure for this this hearing. Is that your thought as well?
It's a bit long.
We lose a lot of the efficiencies of pre-filed testimony if somebody spends an hour going over it.
You know, it depends. I guess my request would be for people to keep things relatively brief, so that we can concentrate on cross-examination, which is the testing of the evidence that you've already submitted. Observations?
Yes, Mr. Smith, I'll perhaps help you out here. We're not going to do summaries of our testimony. Our testimony is summarizing the application and the exhibits. We'd have layers of summary. So we'll just launch right in if it's agreeable with you. I did not recall hearing you recite whether the direct testimony was and rebuttal testimony of the applicant was admitted.
That's a good observation. I did not. Again, I hope I can understand this here, Mr. Kaneki. And this is this would be TC what 2D, 3D,
correct?
3R,
yep.
4D, 4R, 5D, 5R, 6D, 6R1, 6R2, 7D, 7R, 8D, 8R.
And that's the end, I think.
Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Those exhibits are admitted into evidence pursuant to stipulation.
At this time, I'd call Robert Jones to the stand.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Mr. Jones, would you state your name and address for the record, please, your business address?
Robert Edward Jones, 450 First Street Southwest,
Calgary, Alberta.
Mr. Jones, are you an employee of TransCanada?
Yes, I am.
And can you tell us what your position is?
I'm the vice president of the Keystone Pipeline Project.
Did you file direct testimony in connection with this proceeding?
Yes, I did.
Over on the corner of the desk there, I believe yours is on the top.
I have it.
Does that appear to be your testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that testimony?
I do.
I'll ask you, at the time the application was filed, how many barrels per day did Keystone propose to transport?
At that time, we stated that we were proposing to transport 435,000 barrels a day. As a result of a recent open season, we have underpinned contracts of 495,000 barrels a day. The pipeline is now designed to propose to move 591,000 barrels per day.
And so you intend to construct the pipeline as and are asking for a permit as if the pipeline will carry 591,000 barrels per day?
That's correct. The nominal capacity proposed will be 591,000 barrels per day.
Mr. Jones, there's are you familiar with the Keystone requirements for assistance in the areas of maintenance and emergency response?
Yes, I am.
Will you tell the Commission how, in fact, the Keystone intends to staff that enterprise?
Certainly. The evidence that we've submitted so far described permanent staff with regards to just basic operations, and in fact the operations at 435,000 barrels per day. What the evidence doesn't have is what we will require for maintenance and what we require for emergency response. The reason it doesn't include that is because much of that work in regards to the details of the maintenance and the details of the emergency response will identify those people. However, I can tell you that there will be a tremendous number of people that will be contracted. The activities we're talking about is not activities that's required on a day-to-day basis, like operations. With operations, you need to have permanent employees because they're working constantly. But for maintenance, it's and for emergency response, that is not full-time employment. You contract that work because they work for numerous other pipeline companies.
Mr. Jones, I've put in front of you what I've marked as Exhibit TC-14. Is that a document you're familiar with?
Yes, it is. I have it.
Was it prepared under your direction?
Yes, it was.
Can you tell the commissioners what it is?
What the Exhibit TC-14 is an adjustment to the South Dakota ad valorem property tax impact as expected under the revised cost estimate. The filed cost evidence was based on a cost estimate of $300 million. The new cost estimate is $500 million. The increase from $300 million to $500 million is a combination of factors. We did the estimate originally in 2005. Since that time, we have negotiated a tremendous number of contracts for construction and for acquisition of materials. So the new estimate is based on what we expect to be as-built dollars and obviously was exposed to significant inflationary pressures. So the increase recognizes a greater detail in the estimate and also considering that we'll need additional pumps because the capacity is increasing from 435,000 to 590,000. So a combination of all those items is why the cost estimate has increased to 500,000 barrels a day. 500 million dollars. These taxes that we've shown here, $9 million to the counties and $7 million specific of that $9 million to the school districts, is a reflection of that revised cost estimate.
Mr. Jones, you don't know whether the actual taxes will be as listed in Exhibit 14, do you?
No. Thank you for that. It is anticipated. So this is what we anticipate they will be. Obviously, when we're finished construction, the revised capital numbers will be reflected in revised taxes calculations.
I'd ask for Exhibit 14 to be admitted. TC 14, excuse me.
Mr. Rasmussen?
I think what we would object, Mr. Smith, first of all, I don't believe this was pre-filed as we've been hearing everything should be. And secondly, as Mr. Jones has specified, I'd object on lack of foundation. He's admitted they don't know what the actual taxes are going to be. This would appear to be a totally speculative exhibit.
Yeah.
No objection from staff.
Other parties? Do you have a response to the objection, Mr. Kennecke?
We've always accepted additions and corrections to the testimony, and it's been explained clearly that this is an addition based on new cost estimates. Taxes are clearly relevant to the social and economic factors, and this is the best estimate that's available. It's prepared under his direction. I think it's admissible.
The objection is overruled. Have you moved its admission? Have you offered it?
I did.
Okay, it's admitted. TC 14 is admitted.
Mr. Smith, Mr. Kennecke, did we have that that exhibit for review?
Yeah, we haven't. We haven't. We don't have it. We have the original.
You didn't give him one? I'm sorry. I apologize.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones, what will be the maximum operating pressure of the Keystone Pipeline?
The Keystone Pipeline will operate at a maximum operating pressure of 1,440 PSI.
Finally, Mr. Jones, does Keystone commit to comply with all applicable laws and rules?
Yes, Keystone commits to comply with all applicable rules.
We'll tender the witness for cross-examination. Thank you.
Mr. Rasmussen, please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, I'll ask you just a couple questions, first of all, about this exhibit TC-14. In the explanation, it states of the approximately $9,142,000 potential total tax revenue. What does the word potential mean in that context?
My understanding of the way they levy taxes in these counties is subject to change. Based on the 2006 mill levy, this would be the numbers. These are not obviously what will happen in 2010, because the exact capital and the exact levies will be adjusted at that time.
This tax revenue will decrease over time as the pipeline depreciates in value, will it not?
I believe there will be adjustments based on capital, whether the and the assessments. So my understanding, again, of how the levy mills is based on the book value at that time.
Who actually prepared this exhibit?
Under my direction, there is a local firm in South Dakota. I can't recall the name of that accounting firm that came up with these numbers.
So you don't have any personal knowledge of the accuracy of these numbers, is that right?
As is much of this testimony, there are a number of experts that have worked on this project. The the evidence you have in front of you has been done by an expert here in South Dakota.
Now, one of the school districts listed is Condee, which there was recent news stories about that district being so small that they might have to close or consolidate with somebody. You're telling us that they're going to get $819,000 through taxes, that school district? Is that right?
That's correct.
Maybe they won't have to close then. Mr. Jones, you are the one that signed the interrogatories that Webb served, is that right?
Yes, I'm the senior representative.
One of the issues that was addressed in the Webb interrogatories had to do with the various route changes that have occurred over the last several months. Is that right? Do you recall that?
Yes, I recall that.
There was a document that was attached to the interrogatory answers which summarized some of those route changes.
Yes.
Do you have that available to you? Or maybe Mr. Kennedy could.
Well, he's looking for it. Reed, could you pull that mic over a little closer to your mouth, please? It's picking up kind of quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Have that now?
Yes, I do.
Does that document summarize all the route changes that have been made since April 27 of 07?
The expert witness to testify with regards to specific questions on route should go to Mr. Koski.
So you don't know?
I believe this is a very accurate summary, but on specific details, and you must recognize that as we work with landowners and agencies, there may be slight changes. The most recent information, the most accurate information, will come from that expert.
Are you familiar with the various route changes that are listed here? I mean, if I ask you questions about them, are you going to be able to respond to them?
No, I'm not.
But Mr. Koski would be able to do that?
Yes.
Is Mr. Koski the one that makes the decisions if a route's going to be changed or denied, or a request to change is going to be denied? Is he the one making that decision?
Mr. Koski will make the recommendation. The decision usually considers a number of factors and a number of parties. So if it impacts construction, then we'll need to hear from the impact from Mr. Gray. If it impacts the environment, then we'll hear from potentially Mr. Ellis. All of the experts consider every route change, but the ultimate decision on the route lies with the company, and I represent the company.
Looking at your answer to paragraph 6 of the interrogatories, that question asked about pipeline leaks, is that right?
Yes.
And you identified four failures in the past 5 years related to external corrosion and three related to third-party damage, correct?
That's correct. This question, commissioners, was regarding leaks on all of TransCanada's pipelines, which is an extensive network throughout North America, over 36,000 miles. And we advised that there were four failures in the past 5 years due to external corrosion and three failures in the past 5 years due to third-party damage throughout that entire extensive system.
And these were these all natural gas pipelines? Do you know?
Yes, they are all natural gas pipelines. I just wanted to make sure there wasn't. We also have storage facilities, so I just wanted to make sure to include the storage facilities.
Does TransCanada currently operate any crude oil pipelines?
Currently, TransCanada does not own, operate any crude oil pipelines. That's correct.
Has TransCanada ever built a crude oil pipeline?
Yes, we have.
How many of those have you built?
Well, the company, over time, we've been in existence since the 50s. There have been a number of pipelines. There are two really applicable ones. The Express Pipeline that runs from Hardisty into Montana and Wyoming, and then the Osensa Pipeline that we built across the Andes Mountains in Colombia.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jones. Could you say that second pipeline again? The Express and the...
Osensa Pipeline.
Thanks. Yeah.
The Express Pipeline, I'm sorry, runs from where?
Hardisty, Alberta, down through Montana and into Wyoming. And then it connects with the Platte Pipeline, which TransCanada also was a joint venture partner in, that moves then from Wyoming through Missouri and into Illinois.
Are you familiar with the seven failures that are referenced in the interrogatory answer?
The expert witness that can best respond to those would be Ms. Mira Kathari.
TransCanada has had other failures. This lists the ones in the past 5 years. Before the last 5 years, there have been other pipeline failures or leaks, correct?
That's correct.
Who's the person that would be best to respond to questions about the other pipeline failures?
Mira could, but I could also certainly attempt to try and answer any questions you might have about the history of pipeline failures.
Well, I'm familiar with a failure in April of 2002, a natural gas pipeline cracked due to corrosion near Brookdale, Manitoba, causing the evacuation of 100 people within a 4-kilometer radius. Are you familiar with that one?
Definitely the Brookdale incident would be best answered by Ms. Kathari.
Okay. December 2, 1997, a natural gas pipeline ruptured due to external corrosion near Cabri, Saskatchewan.
Cabri, yeah.
Or Cabri, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we'll have, a little French-Canadian there.
Okay. are you familiar with that one?
Again, the specific incident is Ms. Kathari is the correct witness. So if you have about general industry failures, I'm the appropriate witness.
But if I want to ask again about these specific instances, she would be, or is it a she or he? I guess I don't.
She.
She would be the best one to talk about that?
That's correct.
Paragraph 11 of the interrogatory answers indicates that TransCanada has not sought any tax incentives from the state of South Dakota, correct?
TransCanada has not actively sought any tax incentives. Any tax incentives that we may consider already within the legislation.
There's a statute that arguably would allow TransCanada to decrease its sales and use tax payments by 75%. You're aware of that?
I'm aware of that.
Is it TransCanada's intention to make use of that statute and reduce its taxes in that manner?
Those taxes will be paid by our contractors, and I would only assume that they would consider the laws and apply as required.
If it's available to them, you would certainly assume that they would take advantage of that tax break, correct?
I think that's a reasonable assumption.
According to paragraph 12 of the interrogatory answers, some portion of 56,240 tons of the steel that's going to be used will be manufactured at a facility in India. Is that right?
Yes, there's three. We've contracted the pipe to three different facilities. Pipe is made all over the world and is built to U.S. standard API 5L. The plants we've negotiated with are in Florida, Oregon, and Wellspun, India. The Wellspun, India mill is a former Canadian mill out of Welland, Ontario, that has been reassembled and is in the city of Wellspun. That mill today produces tens of thousands of tons that is imported into the United States, and thousands of miles of pipe are built with pipe that has been produced out of this mill.
According to the interrogatory answer, 14,632 tons will come from the facility in Florida. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then the remaining 56,240 tons will come from either the Portland, Oregon plant or the one in India, correct?
Yep.
Do you have a breakdown between those two as to how much of that will come from Oregon and how much from India?
No, I don't have the details. It's really a matter of different applications, timing, logistics with regards to transportation. So until those details are figured out, but nonetheless, the three mills that we're looking at are the three described I just previously described.
How is pipe transported all the way from India to the location of this pipeline?
Pipeline logistics, whether it's from Florida or from Oregon or from India or anywhere else in the world for that matter, is carefully done through through different specifications that we have to follow under the PHMSA. We expect to use tankers from India, and then when it gets on shore, we can use barges, rail cars, and trucks to ultimately get it onto the right of way.
Does TransCanada agree that rural water system pipelines that you cross are high consequence areas under federal law?
I'm not an expert in the definition of high consequence areas. Mr. Koski is, but I believe the answer is no.
Paragraph 26 of the interrogatories, a request was made for a 42-gallon barrel of the tar sands crude oil that will be shipped through the pipeline to be made available for testing. There was no response to – there was an answer then about the general physical and chemical properties of the crude oil and references to some websites, but there was no response to the request for a sample. Would TransCanada be willing to provide such a sample?
No, we wouldn't. TransCanada is, as I've described in the past, the trucker. We don't own the oil. We don't make the oil. We have a specification that has to be rigorously met and will be tested on the properties that come into the pipeline. So we have a specification that we have filed. Certainly, there's a variety of crude oils in Western Canada that are consumed every single day here in the United States, and we intend to transport those crude oils.
But you won't make any of those crude oils available for independent testing. Is that, do I understand that correctly?
That's correct.
Paragraphs 30 and 31 of the interrogatories asked for, 30 asked for operational records for any pipeline built by TransCanada, which has experienced any spills or leaks, and for some more information in that regard. And paragraph 30 asked for any leak reports for any pipeline built or operated by TransCanada. And the answer to both of those questions was that TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP has not built any pipeline to date. No information exists. Can you explain that response?
I object to the question. The counsel has not accurately described the question in the interrogatory. The question asked what the applicant had done, and the applicant is TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP. It's not TransCanada, the That's not the question that was asked in the interrogatory, and so I object to the question. It's not stated as it was in the interrogatory.
Well, I'm sorry. Can I?
Do you want to rephrase the question slightly?
Yes. We'll just look at number 31. 31 asks, produce any and all leak reports for any pipeline built or operated by applicant. And then the answer was, the applicant, TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP, has not built any pipeline to date. No information exists as requested. Can you explain that answer? So the applicant in this proceeding has never built any pipeline? Is that the way I read that?
No, the question was specific to a company, TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP, which I believe is a U.S. company registered in Delaware, and will be the company that will build the pipeline. If you're asking the question, I assume you were trying to ask, was provide all the leak reports for all instances in TransCanada's extensive network. TransCanada owns and operates 36,000 miles of pipelines. It's unreasonable to expect us to produce all these leak reports for our history. However, we do file every leak report. It's documented to the smallest amount, and that's why the Dow Jones Sustainability Index 6 years in a row has nominated TransCanada to be on their top 100.
So you didn't answer the question because I didn't know that the applicant had no experience in building pipelines. Is that why you answered that way?
No, it's the specific company is the applicant, TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP.
So the specific company that is the applicant in this proceeding in South Dakota has never built a pipeline. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty common for all pipelines. You'll find that a new company is formed and they file the application, so the question was directly specific to that company. I believe it's a legal question you've asked me.
Well, I guess I didn't think I was asking a legal question, but that's the way you responded. That's fine. Few questions about your direct testimony. Do you have that available to you?
I do.
Several times this morning and throughout the direct testimony of a lot of the witnesses, that there's reference to nominal capacity. What does that mean?
Pipelines are designed with consideration of what they're able to operate on a predictable basis. The 100% design capacity is 10% greater than the nominal capacity. The Keystone pipeline will operate at a 90% design factor, in other words, the operating factor. So we'll design it to move physically move or have the capability of physically moving 10% greater, but to be able to go to customers and say, what can you predict? What can you ratably move every day? You use a nominal capacity.
You indicated in your testimony here this morning that Keystone currently has contracts for 495,000 barrels per day. Is that right?
That's correct.
And those contracts are with ConocoPhillips and Suncor?
No, they're with a number of companies. Those two companies have identified themselves as shippers. But no, there are more companies. They are both producers in Canada, and they're both U.S. and Canadian producers in Canada, and there are refiners. Numerous refiners that are American companies based here in the United States.
When you say those two companies, ConocoPhillips and Suncor, have identified themselves as shippers, what do you mean? Where have they identified themselves?
In other hearings. That would be the place that they identified themselves as.
Who are some of the other shippers?
Under the transportation service agreement that we signed with them, I'm under confidentiality not to describe the terms of the those companies. It's a competitive business, and like I said, ConocoPhillips and Suncor have identified themselves, but the other companies have not.
You mentioned in your direct testimony that the final EIS is expected in November or December of 07. That hasn't been issued yet, has it?
No, my understanding, talking to the State Department, is that they are working diligently on finishing the environmental impact statement, and we still are anticipating to receive the final environmental impact statement by the end of the year.
Are there plans for additional pipelines to run down this same corridor that we're talking about here today?
Plans. TransCanada is in the business of developing pipelines. If in the future, you know, we're trying to build all sorts of different pipelines to different spots, whether they be in the West Coast, the East Coast, the Midwest, the Gulf Coast. There is such significant amount of oil in Canada, and there's such large refining capacity here in the United States that we are proposing to try and build additional lines. There is no formal application to build a second pipeline along this route, but certainly I don't want to rule out the fact that sometime in the future there may be another line.
It's my understanding that at least some of the easements that have been negotiated allow for the additional pipelines to be placed on the property of those people who have signed the easements. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's very common in the industry to call that multi-line rights or request multi-line rights, and you would negotiate authorization for an easement to put more than one line in the easement. And so we've asked for that, and again, I think that's an anticipation that sometime in the future we may be successful, but we would have to follow the same processes as we are doing today.
Look at page 7 of your direct testimony. It would be right at the top of the page. I think it would be part of paragraph 15, which starts on the prior page. But you state that Keystone doesn't believe that property taxes paid to each county will be counted as quote-unquote local effort. What's your understanding of what that means?
Excuse me, counsel. I didn't hear the question. Did you say does or doesn't believe?
It should say does believe. If I said doesn't, I apologize.
Again, I don't profess to be an expert in tax law here in South Dakota, but my understanding is that the benefit, the taxes will be levied. Keystone will pay the taxes, and they will be distributed to the counties and to each school district. And the formula, whatever it will be when we go to pay those taxes, if they're counted as local effort and there is a reduction from the state into those school districts, it will still benefit the entire state of South Dakota. It's just my understanding is that there is a balancing that would occur.
Paragraph 19 on that same page, you state that delay or termination of the project would have substantial adverse impacts upon the local economies. I won't argue with you about termination, but how would the delay in this project, if more study was necessary, have substantial adverse impacts upon local economies?
The refineries in the United States are desperate for additional crude oil from reliable sources. The price of oil, as you know, is extremely high today, and that's due to the instability of supply. So certainly the continued high price of gas here in the state will continue unless we build infrastructure, not only Keystone, but other infrastructure to ensure the reliable supply of crude oil. On top of that, our project is certainly within requires to be built within a certain time frame for us to remain economic and to proceed. And so any undue delay will have a drastic impact with regards to our ability to remain competitive and to proceed with construction.
In the testimony you presented here today, you told Mr. Kennecke that a tremendous number of people will be contracted, which would include the emergency response people. And then I think you also said that those type of people also work for other companies, is that right?
Other pipeline companies. In fact, there are today because of the when you think of the other pipelines that are in the state, there's refined products pipelines, there's natural gas pipelines. They have all contracted for maintenance and for emergency response, and we too will do the same. So, in fact, we do operate a pipeline here in South Dakota. We operate the Northern Border Pipeline. And we have a number of contractors for maintenance and for emergency response on top of the permanent employees that we have here in the state.
I'm interested in the emergency response people. For instance, the Northern Border emergency response people, where are they located or stationed?
The actual details on emergency response people would be best answered by Mr. Brian Thomas. As for Northern Border and those emergency response people, that's not relevant to this hearing. However, I could tell you, I can't tell you the details because I don't personally run that division. But I do know that the contractors and the people are based here in South Dakota.
Well, I guess this pipeline is obviously relevant. Tell me about this pipeline. Where are these emergency response people going to be?
Yeah, and I agree that it's a relevant question that Mr. Thomas is the best answer.
Okay. Can I have just a minute?
Sure.
Just a couple other questions on these contract workers.
Mr. Rasmussen, could we wait just Commissioner Jansen stepped out for just, he'll be right back. I apologize. Mr. Johnson's back in the room. Please proceed, Mr. Rasmussen. Thank you.
Thank you. On these contract employees, do I understand they would be employed with other companies that TransCanada would then have a contract with? Is that the way that works?
It can work that way. Again, the specific details will be developed over the next year. We have to have the ERP finalized prior to operation. Once the ERP has been finalized, it'll identify the appropriate personnel and their location. And in order to identify, once we've done all that work, then the contracting and training of all those people will need to occur before we commence operation in the fourth quarter of 2009 as well.
But just in general, you've worked with contract employees in the past, correct?
Yes, all pipeline companies need to work with contract employees.
And so I'm just wondering, are these people that are employees of other companies, or are they just individuals that you enter into a contract with? How does it work in general?
It really varies. It's not, you know, I mean, so there are experts that you can hire with regards to certain activities, but there are activities where you would hire individuals as well. So, like, for example, transporting would require just an individual, or the movement of dirt would require just an individual. But that there are companies that have specialized equipment that you would hire them. So the more specialized tends to be a company, and a contractor, an employee would work for them and would be trained according to our ERP.
These contract employees, however they're hired, they would not be TransCanada employees. They would be either independent contractors or employees of another company.
That's correct, but they would still have to comply with the ERP and be trained according to the rules and regulations and the laws that will govern and this pipeline is regulated to.
But there'd be a good chance they would also have responsibilities with other pipelines.
I think that's reasonable to expect.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
At this point, Sherry, would you like a short break? We're going to take a 5-minute recess how about from now until 11 o'clock to give our court reporter a rest. second session. I note that at the outset, usually I take appearances of counsel. I know there's some pro se people in the room as well. But I think probably our reporter knows all counsel, except do you want to, we have one pro hoc attorney from outside the country, or outside the state. And do you want to put in an appearance for him?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Smith. My name is James White. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Sidley Austin, LLP, in Washington, D.C., and I've given my contact information to the reporter, appearing on behalf of Keystone.
Thank you. Mr. Rasmussen, were you done?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Staff?
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. Just a few quick questions. Is there any change to the pump station locations with the new pumping capacity?
No, I'm not. The additional pumping capacity just requires additional pumping units.
So are there still then the 14 valves in South Dakota, or will there be additional valves in South Dakota?
I'd ask that I don't recall there being any difference in the number of valves. However, the exact number is probably left for Mr. Gray to answer.
Thank you. Nothing further.
I guess I neglected to inquire if other interveners have questions of Mr. Jones. Mr. Hone.
Yes, I do. I'm an individual intervener as well as being involved with Webb, and I have a couple of questions.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Jones, TransCanada has been a partner of the Northern Border Pipeline how long?
I object on the relevance of that question.
Well, the next question, I could change the question.
Overruled. If you know, you can answer.
I guess I don't know the specific details. I know the pipeline was built in the 80s, and I believe we've been in part of it ever since then. But I'm not an expert in the holdings of the Northern Border Pipeline.
Thank you. The Northern Border Pipeline is owned by a number of parties. The management or operating of that pipeline, does that change from year to year or time to time?
Again, I object on the relevance. The Northern Border Pipeline is not at issue in this proceeding.
Overruled. The witness himself brought it up, so please proceed.
Pipeline is owned as a joint venture between One Oak and TC Pipelines.
Mr. Jones, as one of the utilities, water utilities in the community, we have had some contact with Northern Border over the 20 years or so that they've been in operation. At one time, did Enron manage the operation of the Northern Border Pipeline?
Same objection.
This seems to be getting quite a far out there, but overruled.
Mr. Smith, I'd like to take just a minute to get some more information. I may have an interest in overruling.
Okay.
Mr. Hone, could you just quickly give us an idea of where you're headed with this? I'm trying to determine relevancy.
The relevancy is in terms of how the staffing and operation has been handled. And for a long time, this pipeline, Northern Border, had in-house operation staff, and they've reduced the staff over the last, say, 10 years, 5-10 years. And they have less in-house staff and more contract staff, which is relevant in terms of how you operate. And the question is, if that's the way this one is operated, should we assume the way Northern Border is operated is the way TransCanada will operate this pipeline? If they are a party to both pipelines.
I'm trying to remember the information immediately prior to that. Did Mr. Jones indicate that, you know, TransCanada is sort of the managing partner of Northern Border?
I'm sure he could restate.
That's correct.
Okay. I have no motion at this time.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, I fully agree with you, and I appreciate your starting to pursue that because Mr. Jones was just touching on the Northern Border Pipeline. I don't know that former ownerships and things of that nature, and if you could cut to the chase, yes. Ask the question as opposed to the editorializing. We appreciate it.
Yes, Mr. Commissioner. My question is you know, Northern Border has been represented by you as an example of a pipeline of how it would be operated either by you or whoever the partners are in the future on your Trans-Canada Keystone Line. It is true that they used to have in-house staff operate it, and now some very senior operations staff, and now they have less.
I object, lack of foundation.
Well, I'm asking the question, if there's been a change in how it was staffed from in-house to a more contracted operation, if he knows.
The objection stands.
Can you, I think your problem, you're combining an awful lot of things into one question. Maybe you break it down into pieces. Okay, go ahead.
I don't know.
The next question, Mr. Jones, relating to taxes, this was TC-14, the document you just handed out today, the first time we had seen it this morning. You said that the portion of the pipeline in South Dakota would be worth $300 million. That was the original estimated value. And then that estimate has increased because of increased costs, and which I assume are labor and material. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yes, the costs are labor with regards to construction contracts, materials with regards to the such things as pipe valves, pumps that are required. There's also a time issue. The estimate was done in $2,005. This current estimate is now in, as we expect, dollars. So inflationary pressures are reflected in the cost estimate.
The question then is the cost increase increased, looks like, about 40%. The taxes increased 30%. Is there a reason, as far as you know, based on the information that you're aware, why there'd be such a difference? Wouldn't they go up the same?
Again, I think they're both based on estimates. The level of detail in this one is of a higher accuracy. Only as I answered before in the previous questions, these are what we anticipate them to be in 2010.
Along that same line, the school districts that are listed, I assume what you're saying there is the taxes would be collected in those geographical school districts, and they would be centrally assessed by the state, but that the money doesn't necessarily go back to them. You said that, if I understood you correctly, it's collected locally, but you're not familiar. You haven't talked to the Department of Revenue as to how much would actually go back to each school.
I don't understand what the question is there.
I don't either, I guess. Mr. Hone, if I may, are you just asking basically, he's got an estimate of $259,000 for Bridgewater. That's an estimate. Do you want to know, is that going to go into the school district's checkbook?
Yes, Commissioner Colbeck, what I'm asking is it a net gain for the school district? Do those numbers represent what each of those school districts will get in addition to what they got last year?
But that's asked and answered. If that's the question, we've gone over that already, I think.
Do you know?
Again, I think my answer was in the past that there is a balancing, that the money does get collected by the schools. Whether or not the state then continues to fund in the same level, I think, does change. The bottom line is that the benefit to the state of South Dakota is as described here.
Okay. The next question is, of the pipelines that you own or built, is there a pipeline by the name of Foothills Pipeline that you either acquired or built?
Yes.
Did you acquire it or build it?
We built it.
You built it. And where is Foothills?
There's actually a number of Foothills. There's Foothills Saskatchewan, which runs from the Alberta border diagonally and feeds into the Northern Border Pipeline. And there's Foothills BC that runs from the Alberta-BC border and runs into United States to feed markets in the Northwest. And there's Foothills Alberta, which is pre-built the Alaska pipeline that runs throughout the province, and there is Foothills, Yukon, which is a pre-built, that has not been built yet, but it has been proposed, and there's been regulatory proceedings.
Of the foothills you've listed, which foothills bring oil into the United States?
None of them.
None of them. That was not on your list. I was just wondering, is that, that is a recent pipeline that you've been involved with?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, let me move on. You're familiar, you have obviously competitors like any company, and you're competing. Are you competing now with Enbridge Pipeline to bring oil, tar sands oil, into the U.S.?
Keystone will compete with a number of pipelines to move oil from the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin into the market. There are existing players. The existing players that move significant amounts of oil are the Enbridge pipelines that move oil in towards the Chicago market, which is not a market for Keystone, and the Express pipeline, which basically moves Canadian crude into the Wyoming markets, which again is not a market for Keystone. But there is an ability for the Express pipeline with Platte and the Enbridge pipeline with Spearhead to compete with Keystone at Cushing and at Wood River Patoka.
And so the Enbridge pipeline, being the vice president, a high-level executive of this company, you have to be quite familiar with your competition, I would assume.
Yes.
You're familiar with the Enbridge pipeline that runs through Clearbrook, Minnesota?
Yeah, I'm aware of
it. You're aware that they had an explosion, tragedy here recently?
Yes, I am. This incident is a tragedy. TransCanada is certainly saddened by that incident, and for the families and the co-workers of the many who lost their lives, I want to tell the commission that the industry takes these incidences very seriously. The TransCanada Keystone Pipeline is a member of the Association of Oil Pipelines. They'll be taking this incident very seriously. There's a thorough investigation being done by federal authorities, by being conducted by state authorities. The investigation will result in a report. The report will have recommendations with regards to what happened with regards to the incident, and Keystone will implement any recommendations that come out of that report.
Mr. Jones, are you aware of the thickness of the steel of the pipe built and operating at Clearbrook, Minnesota?
Again, I don't want to get into the details because I don't know them. I am aware that it was what they call Line 3. That is a pipeline that was built many decades ago, and it's great in mole thickness. I don't have the details.
And the pipe that failed, is that the pipe that leaked previously that they were going out to repair? Do you know? There were two pipes involved.
I object. He said he didn't know the details.
Well, he hasn't answered this question. Does he know the second pipe that had the pinhole leak that was also involved in the incident?
There's a total lack of foundation for this question. I object. Do you know?
No, I mean, I'm like all of us in the room here. I only know what information's been reported, so I don't know those details.
The objection is sustained.
Mr. Jones, do you know what pressure and what volume the Enbridge pipeline through Clearbrook, Minnesota runs at?
Again, I object. He said he didn't know the details.
But this is a different detail.
I think he just testified that he doesn't know any more than what you and I have read in the media.
Okay. The pipe that has been made in India, or any of the other plants you've listed, Florida, Oregon, and India, before you contracted with those pipe companies, I'm sure you did a due diligence in terms of their reliability. Have any of those plants in the last 10 years had produced pipe that then failed in the field under operation that you're aware of?
There's no way I'd be aware of any of that information.
But you would, before you'd buy 1,000 miles of steel pipe, you would check the plant and see what their history was in terms of reliability, wouldn't you?
But that wasn't your question. The question was, have they failed in the field? Once a pipeline has been installed in the field, when it moves, how it is operated, those are all enormous factors on whether or not the pipe will fail. As for the specifications and the due diligence that Keystone will do, it will meet all the laws and rules and regulations according to the codes and standards of the United States. And we are doing industry best practices and certainly going above any standards that you'd have today.
Mr. Jones, if the plant in India had pipe that had failed in a major incident, or if they had a history of problems with reliability, you probably wouldn't want to buy that pipe, would you, as the executive making that decision?
Yep, but there, I don't understand the question. This pipe is being used today. It's built to U.S. standard. It looks, touches, and feels like all the other pipes that you would buy anywhere else in the world. There's nothing unique about it. It is API 5L pipe.
I guess what you're saying is you're not aware that any pipe coming from the Indian plant has been put in, installed, and then failed and had major disaster.
Or the Florida plant, or the Oregon plant, or the IPSCO plant, or any other plant.
Any of the plants you listed.
Any plant in the world.
But you wouldn't buy. Would you buy pipe from them if you knew they had failures?
There wouldn't be a mill making pipe if it had failures.
Okay. I just got a couple more questions. In your testimony and answer in response to Mr. Rasmussen, you used the term 90% design factor. And in all the literature and testimony we've seen, 80% versus 72 or 0.72. Did I mishear that, or did you reference 90% design factor?
I think you're misunderstanding the reference.
Okay.
We're talking about operating volume. Nothing to do with pipe design. We're talking about operating. So we're going to operate the volume at 90%. So that has nothing to do with the pipe thickness or the pipe strength. It has to do with how much oil we think we can move every single day. So like any pipeline, it's very unreasonable to expect to move 100% of its design capacity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So when you consider the capacity, you could either state its design capacity, which is unreasonable to expect that we'll move that much oil, or you can state its nominal capacity. Its nominal capacity is 90%. The range, and again, this is completely determined by the operator when it goes to determine how much product it wants to move down the line. The confusion I believe you were stating is with regards to the pipeline design factor under API 5L, and that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, Mr. Jones, just so we understand, does the 90% equate to numbers of barrels per day? Is 90% 591,000 barrels, or is it a different number?
No, you're right. 90% is 591,000.
Okay, barrels. Thank you. With regard to contract workers, the contract workers, the people that were doing the repair at Clearbrook, Minnesota, according to several news reports, were contract workers. They were not hired directly by the pipeline. They were hired as contract workers. In the event of an injury or a fatality, do they appeal to their contracted employer, or do they appeal to, in your case, TransCanada, if somebody's hurt, injured, or killed?
I object. The intervener not only testified before his question, we've been over this ground before. He doesn't know.
Sustained. He has nothing to do with that particular situation.
Let me rephrase the question then. Mr. Jones, you're familiar, I'm sure, with any contracts and contract workers that do work on the TransCanada pipeline, Keystone, or at least you will be involved in that process. In the case of TransCanada Keystone, when you set up contracts with subcontractors doing work in South Dakota on this pipeline, do your contracts with your subcontractors provide any insurance or death benefit to contract workers, or is that the responsibility of the party you hired to do the work?
I object. I fail to see the relevance of that question in the proceeding at hand.
Do you know?
Well, a number of all pipeline companies hire contractors. They must be qualified. They must be certified. They must be capable to do their jobs. The arrangements that every employee makes with its employers, I don't know how I can answer that question because I think it's such a wide range.
And Mr. Smith, you sort of made a de facto ruling on the objection, and if your objection is to sustain it, or rather to overrule the objection, I might be interested in making another motion.
Are you you're requesting that I overrule the?
I'm not sure I understand the relevance,
Mr. If I could
go ahead. I don't know. To me, the availability of insurance, et cetera, to me might not be totally irrelevant, but how you set up your indemnity coverages. I mean, to me, it's not completely irrelevant to me.
Well, the question was to contract workers, which I'm not sure I see the linkage between contract workers and South Dakota inhabitants or land. I mean, it may be, indeed, that those contract workers would be from South Dakota, but maybe not. I don't know that we have an evidentiary foundation for that.
I'll sustain the objection.
Mr. Jones, you mentioned in response to Reed's question about external corrosion and the incidents where pipe had failed. You spoke to that. What about the same question in relation to internal corrosion? What are the numbers in the last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years of this 36,000 miles of pipe that your company operates, granted natural gas, not oil, but of 36,000 miles of pipeline you operate, the internal corrosion on that pipe over the last 5, 10, and 20 years, how many failures have you had?
The specific expert to answer your question is Ms. Kathari. However, I can tell you generally, internal corrosion is not a common failure mechanism for crude oil pipelines or for natural gas pipelines. Internal corrosion is an issue with pipelines that move what we call raw gas or raw crude oil, which comes out of the oil fields themselves directly and before they get pre-processed. And we don't plan to move any crude oils that would be an issue with internal corrosion. And if you look at our specifications for the product, the crude oil that comes into the line, it clearly identifies the components. And those components highly minimize any issue with regards to internal corrosion.
One last question, Mr. Jones. In regard to the product, we requested a sample of the product that could be submitted to private labs in the United States to be examined and tested. And I understand you may take oil from a couple of fields or mines. But with all due respect, how will we know what the effect an oil spill would have on an aquifer or a creek or a stream or on a water, plastic water pipeline if we do not have from you some kind of documentation that says what this oil will be made of? Because you'd have to admit there are some chemicals in it like benzene, toluene, various chemicals that would have an effect on the environment if they were able to release or leak from the pipe. So how can you say that there's no risk or worry about a contamination or an environmental impact in our water and our community if we can't see the oil ourselves and have it tested by somebody besides your company?
Mr. Smith, I'm going to object to that on a number of grounds. The intervener testified substantially there before finally coming to a question, but what it really points up is something that is finally become clear. The intervener is acting as co-counsel for Webb Water, as alongside acting as his own counsel in this matter. He referred to, "We requested a barrel of oil," I don't know how many times in that statement. the we was Webb Water and was not Mr. Hone himself that requested that. And at some point, I think we need to see a dividing line as to who's representing Webb Water here today.
The objection is sustained. Mr. Rasmussen is representing Webb Water.
Well, as a citizen and someone who drinks Webb Water and lives in the community that you're crossing, I ask you the question again on that basis. How can we feel assured, or how can I feel assured, or any person along the pipe route? What could you tell us, or what could you show us that might come from some maybe more independent party even in Canada besides your company that has analyzed it and would say this is what is in it?
You know, the evidence is clear. We filed evidence with regards to this. The Keystone Pipeline will transport crude oil. The commodities that are that we will move, and the MSDSs are found on the reference web sheet that we filed. There has been significant independent testing with regards to crude oil impacts on the environment, and we have expert witnesses that will be able to testify and answer those questions.
Thank you.
Other interveners? Mr. Meckley, you're going to have to come to a mic, perhaps. Kurt, can you?
I have a pretty good voice. I can just ask.
It won't pick up, and we're actually attempting to make this available to a wide audience via the Internet, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Jones, I'm not quite clear. You had stated that you work for TransCanada. You're an employee of TransCanada. That's correct?
Yes, I am.
Now, you are also working for Keystone?
I am the vice president of Keystone. Keystone has no employees. They're all, TransCanada has the employees.
Okay. And so what is Keystone again?
Keystone is a registered company in the state of Delaware, and also we're registered here in South Dakota.
And it is what? What is Keystone?
It is a pipeline company.
It's a pipeline company. Is it a shell then? What they call a shell? There's nothing in it?
Well, there will be. There will be all the assets, and certainly today holds contracts for 495,000 barrels.
Keystone is a contracting company.
It, that's one of its functions.
And so it isn't TransCanada that contracts.
TransCanada owns all of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline, all the shares.
TransCanada owns Keystone.
That's correct.
And what is...
Just to be clear, the 495,000 barrels a day of contracts was contracted with TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP, and all the applications for environmental impacts, all the contracts that have been let have all been with the entity TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP.
So there is an entity, TransCanada Pipeline Keystone, also? Is that also an entity?
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, I don't either. You're talking about Keystone, and then you're talking about TransCanada, and then you're talking about Keystone TransCanada. Are they all one and the same, then?
Let me be clear. TransCanada Corporation has a number of subsidiaries. One of those subsidiaries is TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP. We refer to it, because that's a lawful long name, as Keystone.
I see. And what is the purpose for having Keystone?
Like all pipeline companies, for example, the Northern Border Pipeline Company or the Foothills Pipeline Company, these are companies that have different ownerships, they have different operating structure, they have different regulatory procedures, so you need to have separate entities to do business.
You say Keystone will have different ownerships. What does that mean?
TransCanada has different subsidiaries. One of those subsidiaries is TransCanada Keystone Pipeline. We refer to it as Keystone. That company then has transactions with landowners, regulators, contractors.
But it is really TransCanada then, isn't it?
100% of the shares is owned by TransCanada. That's correct.
And so the purpose, again, for having a Keystone?
It's to do business with regards to this transaction, which is to transport crude oil.
Now, is this something that TransCanada could have done on its own without having a Keystone?
I object. I don't understand where we're going with this line of questioning. I've let it go on too long, I'm afraid. But.
Can you explain?
I don't understand where we're going with this. It looks like a shell game for a couple companies playing little games here of having, you know, a company here and a company there. We're very interested in liability as landowners. We're interested in a party that's going to be responsible. And when you have this kind of name, now you see it, now you don't, we're very concerned.
Well, I don't. I mean, the company Keystone Pipeline, LP, is a publicly registered limited partnership in Delaware. It's filed here with the Secretary of State. It's a legal entity. If that were the, that's the way companies throughout the world organize themselves. I think the liability issue, if you want to go down that track, that's a different kettle of fish. But in terms of this implied boogeyman, I don't think that's getting anywhere. I think going down the liability track is a pertinent area
yes.
of inquiry.
Let's do that. Who is liable, Mr. Jones, when there is a problem with this fictitious pipeline, this proposed pipeline? It blows up or it burns or it leaks. Who is going to be liable now for this damage?
I object. The intervener's testifying is badgering the witness.
I'm going to sustain that. Can you just ask the question straight up, please, Mr. Meckley, without the characterizations that are prejudicial? And they're not, they're not in evidence, if you get my drift.
Yeah. Well,
Keystone Pipeline is a legal entity. Keystone Pipeline LP is a legal entity. It's a limited partnership. It's authorized to do business in South Dakota by the Secretary of State. And I think, just straightforwardly, I think the question, Mr. Jones, that he's asking is if you could possibly explain what the legal liability arrangements might be between TransCanada Corporation and the limited partnership.
Thank you. Yes, I'll be pleased to answer that question. TransCanada Corporation, through will maintain the responsibilities to ensure that its subsidiary, TransCanada Keystone, will operate the pipelines that follows the rules and laws of the state of South Dakota and of the United States, and part of that is an obligation to operate and maintain the pipeline in a safe fashion. So if there was to be an unfortunate incident, TransCanada would be responsible to clean up the leak if it was a leak, and repair the pipeline and have it run back into operation.
Now you say that TransCanada would be responsible, then Keystone wouldn't be involved.
Yeah, the legal entity would be TransCanada Keystone.
TransCanada Keystone.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. One other question. When you were introducing yourself, you said that you're a vice president of Keystone. Are you an officer then in TransCanada itself?
I am a vice president for TransCanada. My title is vice president of the Keystone Pipeline Project. That's what I'm responsible for. But I am a vice president of TransCanada.
Of TransCanada itself. How long have you been a vice president over there?
A couple of years.
So you've only worked for TransCanada for 2 years?
No, I've worked for TransCanada for 10 years. I've only been a vice president for two.
Okay. What was your position before that?
I was director. And this is, by the way, in my testimony, I filed this. I was director for business development.
Business development. Okay. I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other interveners have questions for Mr. Jones? Seeing Ms. Anderson. Would you please then identify yourself for the reporter so we have it for the record?
Sorry.
Yep. Is your mic on?
Yeah, I turned it.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Lillian Anderson. Mr. Jones, when you build this pipeline, do you also establish something called a corridor?
I think anytime you build any linear infrastructure, it can be considered a corridor, but we are acquiring an easement from landowners, and that is for transmission, for the purpose of transmitting crude oil.
Okay, so you have a corridor, right?
I struggle with answering. It could become a corridor, possibly.
You have a 50.
But that is not what TransCanada is asking for. TransCanada Keystone, we are asking landowners for an easement.
You are asking for 50 feet of land for a 30-inch pipe, correct?
Yes, that's correct. An easement that's 50 feet wide, a permanent easement. The landowner continues to own the land.
Okay. So whether you want to call it a corridor or a 50-foot easement, what's the potential value to that?
I don't understand the question.
Space in that. May I call it a corridor because that's my word I use?
No, please define.
It's an easement.
Okay.
Define what you mean by corridor, please.
He has a 50-foot easement, which I'm saying makes a corridor, would make a possibility of three more pipes of 10 feet in between. Or, excuse me, two more pipes. This is the third.
Ms. Anderson, are you asking me, is there a potential for three additional pipelines to be in this
I'm
easement?
Asking you the value of this easement space.
I don't know the value.
The value could be very, because once you've established this pipeline, number 2, 3, 15 pipes afterwards will be easier to put in.
Oh, I don't know if it'll be easier, ma'am.
There's a lack of foundation for this.
Yeah, I'm going to sustain that. You're assuming an awful lot there.
I'm just trying to establish if there's a value to them. And if there's a value to them, I'm paying land tax on this corridor, on this easement. So I want to know, are they going to be paying some kind of extra tax because this is a valuable piece of asset to them?
I think that's subject to the motion in limine, which was ruled on earlier.
I'm going to overrule that. Well, I think maybe another way to put that, with respect to the values that, you know, the overall cost of the project, the $500 million you're talking about, does that include the valuation? Does that include a value attributable to the ownership of property, the easement, right?
I'd like to know if that's Mrs. Anderson's question before.
Is that your question?
Yes.
Well, and do you know?
I'm really confused now, so I hate to do this to you. But what is your question, or could you repeat your question, please?
Let's just skip this until I can get it to where we all understand what I'm trying to say. You were at informal meetings in June, were you not, with
yes.
landowners? Okay. At that time, did you not, or your representatives come with a piece of metal that you said represented the pipe that would be installed in the ground?
We came with a representative pipe sampling that was more to show the coating. But, yes, we had a representative sample.
But I also heard your people tell, and they told me, this would be what would be used. At that time, did you not know that there had been a waiver applied for and approved for variance in thickness?
But that sample we gave you is a representative sample of what pipe looks like, the material contact, what it feels like, what the coating looks like. That's what it was there to demonstrate. Because a lot of folks had never seen it. In fact, when we were there, a lot of people thought that the pipeline would be above ground, and so they wanted to have a look at, feel it, touch it.
But there again, the question I had was, when your people were saying that this is the pipe that was going to be used and you see something of one thickness, and at that time you all knew that a waiver had been applied for and approved, was that not slightly deceptive on your part when your people were saying this is the thickness we'll use?
Yeah, I object. There's a total lack of foundation for that line of questioning.
Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I suspect this sample, which I just like to, it was about this big with the size of my hand, and I can't even recall the strength. So one of the most important things, and I like to communicate this to Ms. Anderson, about wall thickness is the strength of the steel. So, for example, if you were to use X100, which is extremely strong, then it results in a different wall thickness. If you use X50, you get a different wall thickness. So the sample that we were passing around was pretty darn close to a sample that that's going to look like the pipe that we're going to install.
Okay, let's skip to one more thing. At those same meetings, you heard different people stand up and say that they did not like the treatment they had received from your land agents. Did you do anything about it?
Yes, we did. TransCanada Keystone has hired land agents that are experts, that are very aware of the concerns of the community, and we've instructed them to treat all the landowners with respect. We then asked for them to communicate any formal complaints, and we have never received any formal complaints from landowners in South Dakota through our 1-800 number or through our process. However, we did instruct them to continue to treat landowners with respect and to continue to negotiate with them to try and get a settlement. There are landowners, however, that do not want to settle with TransCanada Keystone.
I guess I'm having a little trouble with what you're saying formal. At the Yankton meeting, I spoke to Mr. Gray. On May 10th, I had spoke with Mr. Gray. In July, I spoke with Mr. Gray. Is he not part of your company?
He's certainly part of our process, yes.
Well, as I'm speaking to him, I guess I'm assuming that as a representative of your company, along with Jeff Rao and Tim Prescott, and you, as you were sitting there, and I wasn't the only one that said that through the course of these meetings, I guess we kind of assumed, at least I did, that when I spoke to you, that it was pretty much formal.
Well, that isn't formal, ma'am. That is informal. And we asked you, and we asked others, and we have not received any formal complaints. Now, I can assure you, we continue to work with all our landowners, and we continue to make progress on easement payments and settle our easements. And it's our hope and desire that we can settle with all landowners.
That's all right.
Thank you. Any other intervener questions? We're at a quarter to noon. Do commissioners want to proceed with – I think what I would propose for the order here is that we go to commissioner questions in order to enable TransCanada to address any matters that you might bring up on their redirect.
That certainly makes sense to me.
Okay.
Yes.
Commissioners, please proceed.
I'll take first stab unless Steve, okay. You discussed, Mr. Jones, a formal complaint process. Did you mean to insinuate that if a complaint was received informally that nothing would be done on TransCanada's part?
No. Thank you for that, helping me clarify that response. That's not true. In fact, we have talked to all our land agents. We continue to talk to them. I personally get progress reports from them. The exact conversations and details is best directed to Mr. Gray, because those are whom those people report to, and then Mr. Gray, of course, reports to me.
So if I had a specific question about what happened with Ms. Anderson's either formal or informal complaint, that would be best directed to Mr. Gray?
That's correct.
Okay. I think on page 4 of your pre-filed testimony, you mentioned pump stations, valves, and densitometers. I was wondering if you could just give us an idea, those of us that are lay people in the pipeline industry, what's a densitometer?
A densitometer is a device that measures the density of the crude oil that moves in the pipeline. It also has, depending on the sophistication of that densitometer, it can provide signals or data
that we put through a control system. That process or that device is called SCADA, S-C-A-D-A. So the densitometer would produce a signal that would then go to the 24/7 control center, and they'll be able to measure the product when it's coming past a certain point. And it's usually at pump stations.
And so this densitometer, would that help to determine the density of the crude, meaning what pressure it was under, this part of your monitoring system?
No, a densitometer is just purely for density. There are other devices that measure pressure, temperature, and the like.
Okay.
Flow volume.
Commissioner?
Yes.
You might save some time if you'd ask if there are any densitometers to be located in South Dakota specifically. I just don't want to leave an impression there.
What a brilliant question.
Yeah.
Mr. Jones, are there going to be any densitometers located within South Dakota?
With such a massive project, I sometimes forget what state I'm in. There will only be densitometers at our Tourmaline locations, and so one in Cushing, Oklahoma, one in Wood River, and one in Patoka, Illinois. There will also be a densitometer at the upstream location in Canada, at Hardisty.
I'm going to ask a question to try to get to what Mr. Meckley was attempting to ask about. If there was liability that would be assumed by Keystone because of an incident, mm-hmm. and if Keystone didn't have the assets or no longer existed, would that liability flow upstream to a parent company?
That's my understanding. And TransCanada is, continues to be publicly traded. We have to follow the rules and regulations of being publicly traded, which means that we'll have an investment-grade credit rating and have the capability to make sure that we can meet all our liabilities. You can imagine if you operated 36,000 miles, if you were to have a problem with one company, the loan implications would be tremendous. Your rating implications would be tremendous from a financial perspective. So we are very much motivated to make sure that we meet all our liabilities.
Am I right in presuming that if there was a change of ownership or a change of name of the Keystone Pipeline corporate entity, or if it ceased to be and that was rolled into a parent company, that liability wouldn't cease, that the parent company would still maintain liability?
Well, the obligations of the liability sits within TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP. Ensuring to make sure those liabilities are met will be by the owners, whoever they may be. Today, TransCanada is that owner. But the obligation of the liability still sits within TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP.
There, Mr. Jones, there have been some questions about the chemical makeup of the product that might flow through Keystone. Would there be a variance within the chemical makeup of a product from a day-to-day or week-to-week or year-to-year time period?
Not a tremendous amount of variance. It's still crude oil. We in the industry quickly describe things as light or medium or heavy. This will range from what they call a light crude oil, which is in the United States commonly referred to as West Texas, West WTI. In fact, you may see the benchmarks posted business reports. We, of course, can't move WTI because it's produced in Texas, but we move an equivalent type of oil. We expect to. It's called synthetic oil, which will have the same density and properties. And then the other range is what they call heavy oil. And heavy oil is a little thicker. It comes from, again, there's a range of heavy oils that come from Venezuela, Africa, and California. So there's that oil. But at the end of the day, it's still all crude oil, and its chemical composition is extremely similar. And our specification, which was filed, gives the range of the commodity type. So the sediments, the water, the other components are all restricted in its ability to look like crude oil.
Mr. Jones, are you familiar with the direct testimony of Edward Miller?
I'm not familiar, no. I'm aware of it, but I'm not familiar with it.
I'll ask a general question then, and if it's better directed to somebody else on your team, please let me know. There's a reference made to ISO certification with regard to pipe mills. Do you know what that is?
I do, but again, the expert on ISO certification of pipe mills is best with Ms. Smith or Mira Kathari.
I will ask Ms. Kathari then. Mr. Smith, that's all the questions I have at this time.
Other commissioner questions?
Yes, Mr. Jones, I just have one maybe to try to clear up Mrs. Anderson's question. Corridor is actually defined as an area or stretch of land identified by a specific common characteristic or purpose. Is it common for pipelines to stay in the same area? In other words, in electricity, we see new coal plants built next to existing coal plants, new nuclears next to existing nuclears. Is it common in this sort of an energy field to build a pipeline next to an existing pipeline?
I would say it's common for a pipeline, when it's filing its environmental impact, to look at other linear structures. They may be power lines, and they may definitely be other pipelines.
Okay. Could you give me an example of where in the pipeline industry, in this organization that you belong to, where there are three or four pipelines laying in the same trench?
Certainly, it's very common for there to be two or three, and in very remote occurrences, there will be more than that. We happen to own one of those, and we have one where there are six and sometimes seven. They were built up over 50 years. And it's not a common occurrence, but it is possible. However, I would say in this circumstance, I think it's pretty remote.
Okay.
But it's not a remote expectation for there to be, for example, two or okay. even three.
Okay. That's something that, as of right now, there are no predictions.
No, that we have okay. no. Even if there were, we'd have to follow this process.
Sure,
Commissioner.
Okay. And this may be to someone else, but would it be you or someone else? You had spoke about the SCADA program that you use to monitor this. Who would be the best authority, would it be you, to tell me how the safety of that versus the Internet compared to hackers? Different safeguards according to that SCADA system.
Brian Thomas.
Okay. And that's all I have for right now.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hansen, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Jones, forgive me, first of all, as a commissioner, I occasionally ask questions that you may have already filed with your pre-filed testimony, and sometimes I take liberties to ask impertinent questions along with my pertinent questions. And sometimes my questions may sound like they've already been asked, but there's something that I'm looking for if I do. I often ask questions that are with pre-filed testimony because I assume that there's at least two or three people out there who haven't read the 8,000 pages of information that's been pre-filed. There's been a lot of consternation about leaks and about the potential for leaks, and there's been rumors circulated, and there's been, a lot of letters, editorials, etc. We are somewhat responsible for turning a blind eye to those things and just looking at testimony that's provided here and supported by evidence. But for those folks that are concerned about the potential for leaks, there have been concerns that there is either a potential for or that there would be situations in which landowners could, in fact, end up being responsible for the financial challenges of mitigation. Can you cite for us any laws, either through the state or through the federal government? And again, if you're the wrong person for this, just mm-hmm. say so. That would be specific to show that Keystone, and I use Keystone in the broadest sense, would be responsible for mitigation?
I will answer that question, and certainly there are other people of experts representing Keystone that may add to my response. Keystone will be responsible to clean up any leak, and Keystone will be designed to prevent any leak from occurring. So, for whatever reason, If the leak occurs, we'll be responsible to clean it up. And I think that's very important to get that on the record. If there was a malicious intent by somebody to damage the pipeline, I think that just has a different legal framework that would occur afterwards. The issue is that the pipeline's leaking, it needs to be cleaned up, and the site needs to be restored, and we would be responsible to do that.
But you cannot cite any specific statutes or federal laws that require you to do that.
I don't have any knowledge of the specific statutes.
Will you have someone in later testimony provide that for us, please?
All right.
Thank you. You just stated that it would be designed to prevent leaks. Will it have? Are you testing for acidity of soil and wrapping the pipe, or placing some type of substance on the exterior of the pipe to prevent exterior corrosion?
Yes. So we are not going to use a substandard coating such as a tape wrap. We're using a industry best practice coating. It's called a fusion bond. This coating is far superior to any of the coatings that have been designed in pipelines that were built pre-1980. We've been very successful with regards to mitigating external corrosion ever since we started using fusion bond epoxy.
What is the name of that again? Fusion bond.
Fusion bond epoxy. A lot of times it's referred to as FBE.
And that is coated around the entire length of the pipe?
That's correct. Even in field joints, there's an epoxy coating that goes in the field joints. So it's plant applied, and then afterwards there's an epoxy coating. And Ms. Cathari can provide even further technical detail with regards to that coating to prevent external corrosion.
Thank you. During the public meetings, there were questions pertaining to the number of leaks, and we seem to have received a number of answers to that. Can you point to the pre-filed testimony, and again, there was some discussion on it this morning, of the number of leaks and what has caused them? I believe today you said there were eight, five of which were failures, and three, and I shouldn't testify here because I'm trying to remember exactly what you said. Would you repeat that, and will you point to the pre-filed testimony that tells us what that is specifically?
Certainly, and I can't answer exactly where in our pre-filed testimony is, and I'll have one of our other witnesses actually cite specifically where it is in our testimony, the information you're asking. The question I received from Mr. Rasmussen was an interrogatory that we received before the hearing. And his question, and if you just give me a minute, I will bring it up, was that he requested us to list any leaks, virtually of any of all of our pipeline system. And, we responded that was just a tremendous amount of work, considering that we've been in business for 50 years and have over 36,000 miles. However, we did specifically address external corrosion and third-party damage, which by far are the number one reasons for any failure. And we said in Canada that we had four failures due to external corrosion in the past 5 years. And in the past 5 years, we've had three failures due to third-party damage. Our record, as time goes on, gets better, and that's because we keep on increasing the amount of pipe that we have that is built with this new higher standard. So the fusion bond epoxy and the technological advances since the 50s and 60s to where we are today is grown quite a bit and is significant. And as a result, we're getting way less leaks.
And I believe you testified that all of those were in were natural gas pipelines, or at least they were.
That's right. I believe there may be some testimony and I'm not sure which one of our expert witnesses will provide it. When we owned and operated the Express pipeline, we provided some evidence on that. But I'll get them to give you the exact location in the pre-filed evidence.
Is the pressure similar in those natural gas pipelines as it is with the with this?
Yes, it is.
I'm assuming the permeability of gas is different than that of the product that you're shipping here.
Certainly the properties of natural gas when it comes to leak behavior and certainly when it comes to the impact on the environment is tremendously different than moving a crude oil pipeline. You know, natural gas pipelines, if they do leak, the product escapes into the atmosphere and disappears. Or, of course, a crude oil pipeline, that's just not the case. The product comes to the surface and remains on the surface until it's cleaned up.
And the combustibility of that product is what you gave us those properties in your pre-filed testimony, and you gave it in the public hearings. And I understand from those hearings that this is ignitable. However, it is not explosive. Is that what you testified to?
That's correct. Crude oil doesn't explode. The vapors that come off of crude oil can be ignited and could be in an explosive environment. A good example of that, for example, is the gasoline in your tank, gasoline tank in your vehicle. The tank explodes because the vapors ignite quickly.
What about the corrosive nature of natural gas as opposed to crude oil?
You know, because we're not moving a raw product under the ground, the corrosive nature, the corrosive products, are the majority of them are removed. So it's very similar that way. Neither one of them are very corrosive.
You went through a process to reduce the, if I use the wrong terms, please correct me, the tensile strength of the pipeline. The reason I ask this question is because in some areas you did not, it's my understanding you did not reduce the strength of the pipeline.
Commissioner,
was it ubiquitous?
Sorry, Commissioner, we didn't touch the tensile strength. I think what the question is, with the pipeline is going to be built with what they call X70 pipe, which is the strength of the pipe. The design factor, which was part of the waiver we applied to PHMSA, the Department of Transportation, which the law allows, we filed this waiver. And for the special permit, and that was to adjust the design factor. And Commissioner, we had to apply to PHMSA. There were a number of conditions, and they did a thorough review of the application. We had to agree to 51 additional conditions that are above and beyond the otherwise regulations. And after their thorough review, they found that the design for Keystone will be of a level of safety at or above whether or not we did not apply for this waiver. So the tensile strength doesn't change. The pipeline is going to be built wherever it is with the same strength of pipe. It's a high strength pipe, 70,000 is the tensile strength, what we call X70 pipe. The wall thickness changes depending on whether or not you're in a populated area or you're in a high consequence area, and that design factor is what we applied for. So the level of safety after PHMSA's thorough review and rigorous review was that the pipeline design remains to be as safe or safer than otherwise.
Causes me to wonder why the wall thickness would be greater in some areas than in others. Obviously, I'm going to assume it's for safety purposes.
Yes.
Why not provide that safety throughout the entire ubiquitous?
You're right, and I would suggest that you would have the same wall thickness through the entire length of the pipeline, except for if you know that you're going to be in areas such as a road crossing where there is a higher likelihood, although, you know, again, we're going to make sure it's deep and such that people won't excavate it and we'll have the one call system that will participate. But if you know that there's a higher probability that somebody may strike that pipeline, then that is one of the main reasons why, for example, in that situation, you'd have slightly thicker pipe wall, because not that it, the the damage would be, it's going to occur, but you want to make sure that, for example, if a bucket of a, the tooth of a bucket of a backhoe was to strike the pipe and cause a dent, that it would dent the pipeline as opposed to actually rupture it. So that's why, for example, that's just an example I wanted to give you why in that one situation you'd have slightly thicker pipe.
When I was in the earlier life in the utilities business, we actually designed some facilities so that they would fail more readily in one area than in others, so that it would decrease the amount of damage to highly populated areas, something of that nature. I'm talking about levees and things of this nature, so that you have a failure point where you're going to flood farm fields as opposed to flooding residential areas. What, if anything of that nature, has been done with this pipeline? Is there any area that is considered to be a more likely failure point than other areas?
No, we designed the entire pipeline so that a failure is not a good thing. We absolutely do not want any failure. So the level of protection is the same. I think what we tend to look at more is the consequence. So, for example, if you were to have a failure near a water course, then the consequence is much more of a concern. But the level of safety remains the same throughout the entire pipeline. So, you know, I mean, and you, because you just don't want one. But it's, I think the issue more goes to consequence. I would probably like to now defer further response to my experts that can handle this question far better than I could.
Is the depth of this pipeline consistent with other pipelines that you, of the 36,000 miles of pipeline that you operate?
No, on average, this pipeline is far deeper. Those 36,500 typically are probably more around 3 feet. The code is 2 feet, and we're going to build this one to 4 feet because that's an industry practice. And the number one cause we anticipate for any failure will be that somebody accidentally struck the pipeline. So to prevent that, And again, the industry takes failures very seriously, then the best practice is to make sure the top of the pipe has a depth of cover of 4 feet.
Can you foresee a situation in which any landowner would become responsible for the mitigation of a failure?
No, I can't, and I'm not even aware if there ever was one, unless it was a malicious act of violence, such as terrorism or something. I mean, but if no, if the pipeline was to fail because of a corrosive spot or some utility company was digging up the line and didn't notify us and they hit it and it failed and leaked on their property, I'm not aware of the landowner being responsible at all, and they wouldn't be.
Perhaps I can help you out with that question. At the public hearings, there were photographs circulated of large implement farm equipment that had been bogged down. Some of it looked like it was well beneath the 4 foot level. In those type of situations where farmer got bogged down with large equipment damage to the pipe, would you say that there's potential for the landowner to be responsible financially?
Only if it was his 10th time or something. Commissioner, I shouldn't jest, but it's very unlikely in that situation that a vehicle could damage the pipeline failure. Extremely unlikely, considering the strength of the steel and the protection of the coating and the depth. So even in those pictures that show that. Now, that being said, you know, we do urge landowners, they know the pipeline's there. If they have large equipment that is extremely heavy and the conditions are wet, then, you know, it would be prudent that they not drive over the line in those conditions. However, if by accident they did, they still would not be liable for the damage. And I don't believe it would damage the pipeline. Now, if they, you know, again, I think we're into a legal grounds now. If they knew they were doing this, that's different.
Thank you. I have just a few more questions. You had testified that the construction will increase the value of property and result in significant amount of taxes being paid by Keystone
to the state of South Dakota. Sorry, I don't think my testimony is to increase the value of property. I believe my testimony is that the taxes as a result of the pipeline are in TC 14, but I don't believe it's because of increasing the value of the property.
Well, it's...
It's because of the asset.
Right. It's a value that is attached to the ground. It becomes a capital asset with the ground. It's a property. It's a real property tax that you are paying, not a personal property tax on that. So it increases the value. Excuse me, what was that figure again? It was different than what we had.
Because the capital cost estimate increased, we're now looking at about $9 million is our forecasted state tax, and we expect 2010.
Have you had, since you've had discussions on that and potential for increase of value and increase in taxes paid, have you had any discussions or did any of those discussions involve the potential for a decrease in the property taxes of the landowner as a result of the easement being given?
No, I don't believe so.
So you're not aware of any discussion pertaining to a potential...
Historically, the price of land has not been adjusted due to an easement of a pipeline on a farm. So I wouldn't expect each landowner to see an adjustment or tremendous change in their personal property tax. Keystone will pay a tax based on the value of the pipe. As for each landowner's property tax bill, it's been documented that the value, the land values tend not to change very much. So I would assume then the assessed property taxes wouldn't change very much. That would be our assumption going forward.
There have been a number of questions pertaining to the capacity of the pipeline. Will this pipeline be able to carry a different type of product?
In a remote situation where we no longer want to move crude oil through the Keystone Pipeline and we don't have a business case to do so, pipelines have applied to be converted to a different commodity. So in the future, do I think it can move something else, let's say natural gas, which, by the way, pipelines have been converted from oil to gas or from gas to oil. Yes, but they have to go through an entire regulatory process to do so.
Would that include the state of South Dakota's regulatory process, to the best of your knowledge?
I don't know that.
Okay, thank you. Have you looked at, and there's been sort of skirted around the question, there have been questions pertaining to a number of other pipelines that could be placed in this easement. Can you give us the maximum number of pipes that could be placed in this easement area?
A general rule of thumb is you like to have pipelines spaced no closer than about 10 feet apart, and you don't want to have the edge of the easement as so you'd go in 10
Do you
feet
mean
from there.
No less than 10
no
feet?
No less than 10 feet, and the edge of the easement would be 10 feet. So that being said, on a 50-foot easement, that would be three pipes.
Okay, thank you.
And we would probably, even then, and I don't know, but in the situation, if it ever was to occur, you would have gone back for the third time to these landowners. You probably are buying or widening the easement and buying a wider easement because just for access to maintain the line.
And you would have to go through a process with siting again or not?
Yes. No, we'd go through the same process.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jones. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Other commissioner questions? I had a couple of – do you want me to ask my few questions now before we break? And then we'll break and you can do your redirect. Either at the Keystone level or at the TransCanada level, does your company carry pollution liability insurance? Or how do you deal with that?
We were just discussing this the other day, and I can't recall exactly how to answer this, so I'm going to get one of my other expert witnesses to respond to that question for you.
Okay, thank you. In terms of capitalization of Keystone, how is that going to happen? Is this going to be a debt financed company?
We haven't determined that. We will be applying to FERC for capitalization. As you know, FERC regulates the tolls and tariffs of crude oil pipelines, and right now it is being funded through the parent, TransCanada. But the ultimate debt equity structure hasn't been determined yet.
This may be an unfair question, but I'm just going to throw it out to let you think about it. You know, the commission has the ability to impose conditions. And would the company, the parent company, be willing to provide at least some level of, I call it a cut-through guarantee, to guarantee that there are liquid funds available to fund cleanup in the unfortunate event we were to have a leak?
Mr. Smith, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. And the main reason is that it's a precedent that the industry wouldn't accept, and companies like TransCanada that are in the business of doing so are responsible for the cleanup, and in order to stay in business and to continue to be traded publicly in the scrutiny of all our shareholders, that's just a liability the parent wouldn't accept. So, we're regulated, we follow the laws and the rules, and it's just I just couldn't see that being an acceptable condition.
I guess if you don't know the capitalization at this point, it'd be hard to know, but if you could give us some indication in terms of the Keystone Limited Partnership itself, can you give us an indication of whether the assets of the Keystone Pipeline will be sufficient on their own to essentially ensure that there are sufficient funds available to accomplish successful cleanup in the event of a spill or leak?
You know, it certainly is. If you look at the estimated capital cost of Keystone today, it's well over $5 billion. Far exceeds any liability exposure there would be on a leak.
And you think, your belief is at least that there would be sufficient cash available to fund any kind of leak that might occur?
Yes.
In terms of the four failures in Canada due to corrosion, external corrosion, were any of those failures on pipe that has the FBE coating on it?
I'd have to get Ms. Cathard to answer that question.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hone brought up benzene and the other toluene and so forth. It's a fact, isn't it, that all petroleum, crude oil, contains BTEX at some level, at least crude oil and refined gasoline. Is that a fact?
I'm not an expert in this. Ms. Tilquist is the appropriate witness to respond to this. I think the question or the implications of BTEX and crude oil as opposed to, for example, BTEX and refined products or gasolines that go in our automobiles is significantly different, and how it reacts is significantly different, and how the BTEX potentially separates out of the crude oil as opposed to out of gasoline. But these complicated questions are best answered and responded to by Ms. Telcost.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have. Should we take a recess for, what do you want? 1 hour? Should we round it off and say, what time does it say up there? Should we say 1:30? We're in recess and we'll reconvene at 1:30.
And we will be shutting off the internet, so those of you listening online will not hear us.